Good morning, everybody. Welcome to your Sunday morning philosophy fest. It is the 16th. Yeah, 16th of February, 2024. And let's get straight to your comments. Hey, Steph, how long do you think it will take for Bitcoin to be the default currency? Well, it did take a bit of a step that way just over the last couple of days. I don't know if you know this. Let me just go and get the facts here. But in the Bank of England is not doing very well when it comes to delivering their gold. So they're supposed to be able to give up their gold within 14 days, but that's not happening. So this is from goldbroker.com. A few days ago, one of the world's largest refineries informed its customers that the London warehouses were empty and that the London gold market was dry of liquidity. Confirmation last Wednesday, the Bank of England published the information that it would be able to deliver the gold currently awaiting delivery only in 4 to 8 weeks. So this is based upon the tariffs on imports, the Trump's tariffs on imports. Many investors see this as an increase in the value or the price of precious metals. Since the announcement of Trump's victory, the COMEX has been facing exceptionally high gold delivery demands. This required a veritable airlift to transfer 393 tons of gold from the LBMA's London warehouse to the COMEX vaults in New York, bringing the New York gold stocks up to 926 tons. This movement emptied the, quote, liquidity available in gold in the Bank of England's vaults. For years, Andrew Maguire has been pointing out that the official rules of the Exchange for Physical, EFP, between the COMEX and the London bullion market require delivery within 14 days. He even gave a presentation on this subject in the House of Commons, thus challenging the government. The fact that the Bank of England can only deliver gold before 4 to 8 weeks is, in a way, equivalent to a, quote, default. The term, quote, failure may seem too blunt, but the reality remains the same. The Bank of England has officially asked other central banks to lend it their national gold, which is supposed to be stored in its vaults. What is happening is dramatic for confidence in the London gold market, the LBMA, which has just proven that the regularly published gold stocks have nothing to do with the reality of the float. That is to say, the gold really available for sale. So, now, Chinese banks have offered their clients the option of keeping their cash in gold instead of yuan. This would have led to very strong demand. To meet this demand, China had bought gold in London starting November 2024. A few years ago, Chinese banks bought vaults in London and New York. For several years, they have been agreed by the LBMA and have been investing in gold. Some of their gold is exported to Switzerland, where the 400-ounce bars have melted down to 1 kilo bars for the Shanghai gold market. Another part of their gold is stored in the London and New York warehouses, where they continue to give the illusion of the wealth of Western stocks, but their metals are most likely not for sale. So this is an intro. I'll put the link in the chat here, but that's important. On X, was it yesterday? People were pointing out that I talked about this many years ago, of course, that the American gold stocks, like the Fort Knox kind of stuff, has been pretty unaudited for quite a long time. And who knows how much gold there really is? Who knows? And if you've ever had, a friend of mine was telling me this, like if you've had crypto on an exchange, you know, they'll independent companies will say, is this the amount of crypto that you have? This is the amount that they're reporting, and they'll verify. You know, I mean, the more reputable, I assume, crypto exchanges will verify that what you think they have and what they actually have match, right? So the untethering of fiat currency from any tangible value. Of course, it hasn't been gold-backed since the 70s, but the US dollar. But the untethering of fiat currency from any kind of gold as a whole, if it's audited and found out that the gold is gone and so on, or that it's moved to China, modern warfare is a complicated thing. And one of the things that's happening as a whole, you know, if you look at, I don't have any proof of this, this is just sort of my theorizing, but, you know, in the same way that you destabilize a country by making a lot of people dependent on the welfare state, right? So you would encourage that. You get a lot of people dependent on the welfare state, and then you work to wreck the currency. And then what happens, of course, is the people who are dependent on the welfare state, a riot. So that's how you would trigger this kind of civil unrest within a country. So if I were evil in China, evil, not China, the people, the China, the government, then what I would do is I would, through TikTok and so on, I would encourage the worst aspects of Western liberalism. But what I would do is I would slowly hoover up the gold in the West, and then I would promote stories pointing out that the West did not have the assets it thought it had, and that would cause a crisis in the currency, which would destabilize my enemies. So again, that's a way that warfare works. So how long is it going to take for Bitcoin to become a default currency? Well, of course, nobody knows for sure, but let's just put it this way. All the elements are in place. All right, let's see here. Why am I not loading more messages here? Sorry about this. Let me just refresh, and you can give me back these comments. All right. So, good morning. Yes, good morning, everyone. Thank you for the tip. freedomain.com/donate to help out the show. I would appreciate that very much. Steph, what do you think about Ashley St. Clair TradCon? So, for those of you who don't know, Ashley St. Clair, well, she's got a somewhat checkered and storied past, to put it mildly, but she became a sort of conservative, anti-feminist, and she was not married, but she has a long-term partner. She has a kid, and then, I don't know, 2 days ago, I think, she wrote The Die is Cast, right, which in Latin, of course, because that's how you do these things, apparently, and she said that 5 months ago she gave birth to Elon Musk's, 13th? She's now Elon Musk's 13th unwed child, right? 13th unwed child. And she said that she revealed all of this because she wanted to keep her privacy. Apparently, the tabloids and the media were closing in. And then she gave a long-form interview. So I don't know how exactly that meshes with the privacy concerns. And then she complained that Elon Musk was not responding to her. She was calling him out because someone posted something salacious and negative. So, I mean, I don't really know what there is to say. I mean, Pearl Davis, I think, has put together a spreadsheet and says, and whether it's true, I haven't checked the math, of course, but that the average conservative woman's partner or husband is worth $5 million. So the theory in general is that you sort of go for the trad wife stuff, and then you get a wealthy man. Now, Ashley St. Clair is like, she's 26, right? So she's young. And I mean, how do you say no to the world's richest man dating you or flirting with you or expressing interest? That is pretty tough. That's a pretty tough thing. Thank you, Anthony. That's a pretty tough thing to say no to. Now, it is, to me, not ideal, of course, that you have a child. I guess this is the second child out of wedlock. And I assume that I don't know what's happened with her relationship with her first, I want to say baby daddy. It seems a little disrespectful, but the father of her first child, I assume that they're not together if she's had Elon Musk's a child. So that's the second out of wedlock child. And now the first child has, I guess, a half brother or half, I think it's a male half brother. It's messy. And it's not obviously not great for the kid, right? It's not great for the kid. The reports are, and I don't know how true any of this stuff is, of course, but the reports are that Elon Musk did not put his name on the birth certificate for, I assume, for reasons of concern and of security and danger and risk and all of that kind of stuff. Because, you know, if you're wealthy, the odds of kidnapping and that sort of blackmail goes up considerably. So it's not really that great for the kids involved. It's not a stable family situation. And I think she's criticized single motherhood in the past. And listen, I mean, I get that a lot of people, and, you know, everybody has this, like, you know, there's a certain amount of external stimuli that will have you want to overleap your values, right? There's a certain, I mean, that's why these sort of external positive or negative stimuli exist, is to get you to overleap or bypass or undermine your values. So, and Milo is like this flamethrower of receipts in general, so you can go look into that if you want. But not great for the kids. Not great for the kids. He's not, Elon Musk, you know, for all of his strengths, and, you know, he seems to be, at least to some of his kids, a fairly involved father, but you just can't have 13 kids by a baker's or half a baker's dozen worth of moms and be a committed a father. Now, historically, that's sort of been the privilege of wealth and power, is you get a harem, right? That's sort of one of the reasons why people, men, are sort of programmed to get wealth and power, because wealth and power triggers hypergamy. Hypergamy gives you access to wombs, and wombs gives you a further spread of your genetics, right? I mean, you go look up Genghis Khan for the ultimate sort of example of the spray and pray method of male reproduction. But it's not great for the kid as a whole. And I won't get into names. You can go look them up if you want, but it was not exactly inspiring to see the number of, quote, conservatives who were congratulating Ashley Sinclair on becoming I would say most likely a single mother. I don't know that that's all been confirmed, but it doesn't seem to be particularly ideal. So it's not ideal for the kids, right? It's not ideal for the kids. Now, I would also argue that it's not particularly great for Ashley Sinclair, because, you know, she's 26, right? So she's got another 60 plus years on the planet. And I suppose this is kind of what she's going to be known for now. And who really is going to want to get involved with a woman with this kind of somewhat chaotic family situation? And who's going to want to be like, oh, you just had a baby with the world's richest man, I'd love to take you to Starbucks or something like that. Like, what happens in terms of loneliness and isolation going forward? I just don't think it's going to be great for anyone involved. All right. Steph, what do you think is the biggest benefit of Trump's tariffs for the U.S.? Well, I assume that the biggest benefit of Trump's tariffs for the U.S. is that it's a negotiating tactic, right? You have to have something to come to the table with as a negotiating tactic. So if you threaten tariff, and this has already worked, right, in terms of dealing with fentanyl and some immigration issues. So you have to have something to come to the table with. Most people, of course, do not negotiate from a moral standpoint, because you don't really negotiate from a moral standpoint. you just remind people of their morals, right? So if you have a deal, which you should have, of course, you have a deal with your wife or your girlfriend, it's like, we don't call names, we don't raise our voices, we don't threaten, we don't intimidate, that kind of stuff, right? So that's not a negotiate. That's a thing you set up ahead of time. You're solid on it, right? So you don't really negotiate that stuff. And then you just remind people that the purpose of morals is to be reminded. And when it comes to conflict with your significant other, you have these baseline rules. And let's say that you start raising your voice and she's like, no, we don't raise voices. That's not a negotiation. That's just reminding you of the rules, reminding you of your moral rules. So most people don't negotiate from a sense of morality, right? So if you were to go to some other country where the leaders really believe in free trade and there are these tariffs, you'd say, oh, listen, I'm not here to negotiate. I'm just here to remind you that we don't, you know, we're free trade people. We don't really do the tariffs. They'd say, oh, you're right. I completely forgot about that one. Let's work to eliminate it, because that would be sort of shared values. So the purpose of shared values is it bypasses negotiation. And really all you do is remind people, right? You remind people. And then, oh, thank you. You're right. I called you a name. I'm sorry. We're not supposed to call names. But I agreed to that. So you're just reminding people, right? You're just reminding people. Like, you know, if you don't pay your bills, like you contract to pay a bill, you don't pay your bill, you don't get negotiation in the email, you get reminders. Hey, you promised to pay this bill, pay your bill, right? These are sort of reminders or prompts or whatever it is to say, do the right thing. So when you're sort of in the chilly, amoral, interstellar spaces between countries, the only thing that works is leverage. There's no particular morals that you are going to be able to remind people of and have them change their behavior. So the only thing that works is leverage, right? So when you're negotiating moral issues, it comes down to financial haggling, right? You know, when you're trying to buy a car and you're haggling about price and features and benefits, or you want a raise and you're negotiating with your boss about the raise. So those are not moral issues, right? Those are just financial wranglings. And countries negotiate with each other absent of morality. And so you need leverage. And how do you get rid of tariffs? You impose tariffs. Right. So, right. It's sort of like if you're supposed to have a monogamous relationship, right? You're supposed to have a monogamous relationship, and your girlfriend says, I want to go sleep with some other guy. And you just remind her and say, no, we're monogamous, right? Oh, let's say you're married, right? And you got kids and, you know, there's a lot of high stakes thing going on. So if you're married and your wife says, I want to go sleep with other guys, and then you say, okay, well, then I'll go sleep with other women. Oh, no, I don't want that, right? So that's leverage, right? And leverage is what happens when you don't agree on moral values. If you don't agree on moral values, then you have to go with leverage. So, I mean, one of the reasons that Europe has outsourced its defense to a significant degree to America is that England or other countries as a whole, they're going to have a sort of significant issue if they go to war, because if they go to war, there will be rebellions in their capitals. There will be rebellions in their home countries. And they probably will be quite paralyzed in terms of warfighting abilities. All right. You know, some new immigrant probably ain't going to want to be drafted, right? So not gonna work out too well. I don't catch your Sunday streams, for I attend church, but I'm sick today. I'm sorry about that, but thank you for the tip. I appreciate that. All right, sorry, let me get to your questions. It's great questions today. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Somebody says, my gold silver guy tells me there's no gold in Fort Knox, and the Fort Knox will never be audited because a massive number of European banks' asset sheets gold were stored in Fort Knox. Everyone knows, according to this guy, there's no gold left, but so long as there is no official confirmation of what everyone knows, then those banks can still rely on the, quote, value of those assets on their balance sheets. Yeah, and somebody pointed out that Fort Knox has not been audited in a while, and Elon Musk is like, oh, interesting. So I wonder. All right. All right. Let's see here. I'm happy to take questions from any source in the known universe. And let me just go through the various places where questions can come in. Elon Musk is a gangster, bro. Well, but his family situation was pretty messed up. You can look at his father's relationship with his stepdaughter, and it's he did not have. I don't think he had particularly healthy family structures modeled for him, if that makes any sense. So that is tough. All right. Bum, love me, say. All right, let me just go and check my bookmarks here and see what is going on. Someone wrote, open hypergamy will ensure that a critical mass of men takes the red pill and will therefore never be able to look at women in the romanticist blue-pilled way ever again. The institution of marriage will not survive this. Women did this. They want this. Give them what they want. Yeah, I mean, I get this anger towards women. I understand that. I don't think it's particularly right or accurate. But as I've sort of said this before, so the welfare state creates an R-selected environment which messes up the sort of cultural evolution of K-selected people, and in this case, women, right? So when women needed men to survive and there were limited resources and there was winter and so on, then women had loyalty and monogamy, and the hypergamy of like women want to marry up, perfectly natural. And I've got no problem with hypergamy. I have no problem with what men and women have done throughout our evolution, because what men and women have done throughout our evolution has gifted me the human brain, and it's gifted you the human brain, which so that's like we're the most successful species in the universe that we know of. And so if you are Michael Phelps, who's really going to say you're not good at training, you did the wrong thing, right? Or Jesse Owens, or I guess even Bruce Jenner back in the day, right? So if you are one of the most successful athletes, right? Like Wayne Gretzky was like the greatest athlete because he was the furthest ahead of number two of any sport. So if you are the most successful species with the most singular and amazing human brain, complaining about how we evolved is ridiculous, because the only reason you have the brain to complain about how we evolved is because of how we evolved. So hypergamy is great. Hypergamy is a stimulus for male ambition and the basis of civilization and so on. Hypergamy is great. But hypergamy is highly consequential, obviously, right? So a woman is supposed to have maybe a 6 to 12 month window where the good men are all getting snatched up. Right? The good men, it's like double or nothing, right? So the good men are all getting snatched up, and the best men are getting snatched up quickly. So the woman's hypergamy is, I want the best man I can get, and the supply of men is drying up daily, right? Like, one of the reasons why there's not a lot of dating going on among teens these days is because no women are really being pursued and picked, because the men aren't talking to women. And it's not just teens, but young people as a whole. you know, almost half of men have never talked to a woman in person, like tried to pick up a woman in person or tried to contact or talk to a woman in person, 25 and under. So because the claw is not taking the sort of high quality women out of circulation, there's no urgency. So women's hypergamy evolved from sort of, she would be presented to society. I mean, I know that's the debutante ball and so on. She's presented to society and then she's got to pick quickly, right? She's got to pick quickly because the quality men are being snapped up by the other women. I don't know if you've ever been, I can't think of a good analogy right now. If you've ever been in that situation where, oh yeah, no, I remember. It's in the dances, right? Like my first dance I went to was like in grade six. I remember with all the boys, we were all analyzing everything after the dance for like 2 hours in a little square by my apartment building. Well, I did this and I did this and what did you know? You're just exchanging war stories, so to speak. So when there's a slow song, right, you had to cross that trench, right? Across the trench, the middle of the gym, across the trench, and then you had to go walk up the row of girls on the other side. And the attractive girls were being picked to dance with. So you had to ask a girl quickly or there would not be any girls left that you would want to dance with. So you had to get across, you know, I walked very fast. I walked very fast. You get across the gym, you got to go talk to the girls and you got to find a girl that's not so attractive that she won't dance with you, but not so unattractive that your men, that your bros will make fun of you for dancing with her. So that's a sort of situation where good stuff is being taken, so you've got to act quickly. So hypergamy is supposed to be, you know, 6 to 12 months max. Now the hypergamy just goes on and on and on, right? Because women stay single forever and they just have access to all of these men and so on. And we sort of talked about this before. And it's funny because there was a guy complaining that I was like, hey man, you're talking about hypergamy and Rollo Tomasi's been talking about that too. You should credit him. It's like, bro, I wrote a novel in like the year 2000 called The God of Atheists talking about hypergamy. I mean, it's not a new thing. I mean, I read the opening bit of that. It's all about a woman having to crash her standards because she's in her 30s. Right? So I never known all of this stuff forever. There's life before the internet, bro. People were reading stuff long before the internet. So it's supposed to be a short-lived thing. Now it just goes on and on forever and ever. Amen. But so I understand men getting mad at it, but the problem is because women's poor choices, if they make poor choices, women's poor choices are so heavily subsidized that they can't make poor choices, right? That they so in the past, like before, you know, child support and whatever it is, palimony these days. But so in the past, if a woman, a young woman, got impregnated by a wealthy guy who wouldn't marry her, her life was over. Her life was over. I mean, she might be able to go on a trip and give the child up for adoption or something like that and come back and pretend that she never had a kid. She might be able to pass, she might stay home for, you know, the last, you know, trimester or whatever. And then she might give birth and then they would pass off her child as her mother's late in the game, whoopsie daisy. And so there would be ways to, you know, everyone would just kind of hold their nose and pretend to go along with it. But it was a way to sort of somewhat stay in honorable society, despite the fact that you had a child out of wedlock with a wealthy guy who didn't stick around. And if you look at like the foundation of the novel was largely about warning women about cads, right? About bad guys, men who will claim that they will love you and who will, you know, will you still love me tomorrow? Who will claim they love you and claim that they will be there for you forever and be devoted and this, that, and the other. And then they have sex with you and then they go, right? Right? Like this old Private Benjamin was an old Goldie Hawn movie where, you know, oh, he said he loved me. He said he loved me. He said he was going to be there for me forever. And then what happened? And then he came. Right. So the sort of sociopath camouflage as a romantic guy and then turn out to be a spray and pray Genghis Khan style seed spreader. Women have been warned about that since the dawn of time and so on. So in the past, if you were a woman and you had a child out of wedlock with a wealthy guy who wouldn't commit to you. I mean, the wealthy guy might be punished. He might be viewed badly. He might be expelled from his church. Those things could happen. But in general, the punishment for the woman was far worse, in that she would often be rejected, ostracized by her family, mostly because her family would say, don't, this guy's not going to settle for you. He's going to use you. And one of the ways in which parental authority is maintained is that you do not shield your children from the consequences of their own bad decisions. That's in preparation for adulthood. So what would happen to women who had children out of wedlock, no matter how wealthy the guy, is they would be cast out from their family, cast out from their church, cast out from their social circle, and they would generally tumble down into prostitution. Because prostitution would be the only way they could make money and still provide something of benefit to their child. So that was the consequence. Your life would be destroyed. Now, on the other hand, I mean, I don't know about Ashley Sinclair and her circumstances in particular, but now if you have a child from a wealthy guy, you get child support and, you know, a certain amount of money, which is probably not inconsiderable, for the rest of your life. You're not cast out of society. I mean, you can see with the Ashley Sinclair situation that in general, the MAGA movement, the conservative movement, is warmly embracing her life choices. So she's not going to be ostracized. She's not going to be kicked out of, quote, polite society. And she's going to make a lot of money. Maybe. I don't know. I mean, we'll see. We'll see what happens in terms of child support. So we don't know. We don't know how it's going to play out, but it's vastly different from how it used to be. Because of child support and because of the welfare state and all these other... I did this show many years ago called The Welfare Cliff, where a woman who has two kids and is on the welfare state basically gets the equivalent of $90,000, be much higher now, which is what she'd have to make before taxes in order to get the benefits that she gets, right? So, and $90,000 in the modern economy is more wealth than 10 generations could accumulate for almost all of human history. Like it's absolutely staggering amount of wealth that a woman can get by having a child. And turning children from liabilities into assets has completely rewritten the entire social contract. So when you take people, people whose sort of morals and society and social standards have all evolved in situations of significant scarcity, and then you turn on the, you know, infinite fruit cannon of the welfare state, then you are putting K-selected people in a hyper-R-selected environment where resources are perceived to be or are effectively infinite. And when you take people who've evolved in situations of scarcity and then you give them a situation of infinite resources, well, it's tough. You know, it's sort of like if you've ever known someone who was unattractive in some manner, usually overweight, they lose weight, they find out that they're very attractive, they'll often go on a promiscuity spree because they were in a situation of scarcity and now they are in a situation of abundance. Yeah, 45% of men aged 18 to 25 have never asked out a woman in prison. So hypergamy has a lot to do with females and females, right? So the male nightmare, I suppose, right? The male nightmare is that you walk up to a woman who's with a bunch of her friends, because women often travel in packs for social reasons and security reasons. So you walk up to a woman who is with a bunch of her friends and you chat with her and you ask her for her number and her friends laugh at you. Now, the woman might like you, but if her friends laugh at you, she can't give you her number. Because if she gives you her number when her friends are laughing at you or giggling or rolling their eyes or something, then she loses status with her friends. And one of the things that has really messed up modern society is that, like, bro culture and sisterhood culture. Yeah, bros before hoes, right? That sisterhood culture is that your primary validation is supposed to come from your female friends. You know, friends forever, friends for life. Boys come and go, but BFFs are forever kind of thing, right? That your primary emotional attachment is with your same-sex friends. It's the same thing true with guys, right? That, you know, strap on for a 19-hour Fortnite session and you've got all the companionship that you need. Of course, your social life, your social bonding, your validation should be coming from your husband and your wife, right? That's where it should be coming from, because you can't make babies with your same-sex friends, right? So rewiring women and men's brains to seek primary validation from same-sex friendships rather than opposite-sex sexual, romantic, and marital unions is really quite powerful. So one of the reasons why men don't go and talk to women is that if the woman is alone, he's been told that he's frightening her, right? That he's is wrong. He's alarming her, right? And you see all of these women in gyms, like they're sort of filming, and some guy glances over and he's like, oh, he's so obsessed with me, so scary, you know? Like, and it is sometimes, right? It is certainly sometimes, and I'm not discounting that, but a lot of times it's just I'm so attractive, right? It's just pushing the I'm so attractive stuff. And so men don't want to go up and talk to women when they're on their own because they don't want to scare them, because women apparently are just terrified of men these days. But they also can't go up and talk to women when women are in a group, because they get that sense that has been quite reinforced in culture that it's the sisterhood of the traveling pants that is what women are really focused on, not the boys who come and go. And so if they go up, because the dynamics are quite complicated, right? So if a man goes up and there's three women, right? There's three women sitting at a table. Man goes up and he focuses on one woman. What is the incentives for the other women that he's not focusing on, right? Woman one, two, and three. He goes up and he talks to woman one, wants to get her number. Well, women two and three are going to be mad about that because he didn't come and talk to them. He didn't come and choose them. So they are going to punish him for not choosing them by discouraging woman one from giving her number to the guy, right? So approaching women in groups sets up a whole ripple cascade of sexual jealousy and competition and tension, which is negative for the man, whereas approaching a woman who's single is terrifying because, you know, women choose bears over men, women are terrified of men, and so on, right? Unfortunately, women presenting themselves as exquisitely vulnerable and terrified selects for sociopaths to approach them, and maybe that's what women want. I don't know, it's hard to sort of say as a whole these days, but 50 Shades of Grey does not exactly elevate sentimentality and affection of women to very high levels. But if you say to men, I don't want you to approach me because it's scary and negative and terrifying and bad and all that kind of stuff, then the only men who will approach women are men who don't read social cues and don't particularly feel fear and don't have a model of the other person's mental state and are selfishly pursuing their own lusts, desires, and preferences. So when you say to men, don't approach me, all you're doing is you're guaranteeing that, you know, sensitive, thoughtful, empathetic men will not approach you, whereas, you know, cold-hearted, manipulative psychos and sociopaths totally will, right? So saying to men, don't approach me, is filtering out sensitive, thoughtful men and replacing them with, you know, cold-blooded users, so to speak. All right. Let's see here. Let's get to your questions. Yeah, I mean, It's very sad. And it is a wild thing. And I honestly don't understand it if you guys have any thoughts. But, you know, the fact that people are so easily programmed to go against their instincts is pretty wild. The fact that just people are just like, you know, you can just say to women, oh, men are your enemy. Men are patriarchs. Men control you. Men are privileged and they have all of the power and you're helpless and have been exploited. And then women are just like, yeah, we hate them men, right? I mean, it's like, I mean, men understand that there are bad men, which is why we fight against them. But putting all men in the category of bad men, rather than there's a small minority of bad men, which women need good men to protect them from, and therefore you have to choose good men to be safe against bad men. All men are bad. It's just, I don't know. How are people so easily programmed? I don't really get it. And I there's some evolutionary reason that I'm sure I'll puzzle out, or maybe you guys can help me out with, but why are people so easily programmed? Why are women just so programmed to just dislike men? I don't really quite get the evolutionary purpose of that as a whole. Dislike men. Dislike men. Men are bad. Men are bad. Men are exploiters. I mean, it doesn't help the genes, right? All right, let's get to your questions, comments. Steph, there's a website called the Library of Babel that contains every book ever written and every book that will ever be written. I don't know what that means. In my school, says Cameron, what happened in the dance situation was literally no one danced. We all just stood around until the music stopped. These are the kids that are now in their mid-20s and have never asked a girl out. What is the cause or solution to this? There's a storyline about the cad in Downton Abbey. Yep, the cad, the hot guy who... there's the hot, cold guy who likes you despite himself. That's Pride and Prejudice. And also in Pride and Prejudice is the guy who claims to like you, but only wants to get in your pants. Right? All right. So the solution to this? Well, I mean, there is no solution until the welfare state is no more or is severely diminished. Steph, what do you think will be the tipping point where women will start being held accountable for bad decisions again? Yeah. I mean, it's the fundamental issue with regards to feminism, right? Which is, I want to be equal to men. I want to be protected from bad decisions. I want to be equal to men. I want to be protected from bad decisions. But you can't have it both ways. I mean, you can in sort of theory, you can in contradictory abstractions, and you can when the next generation is being pillaged to pay for your bad decisions or your bad mistakes. But, all right. Oh, to answer your podcast, hell is not enough. This guy says, no local churches that I know of receive direct government money /USA ID, and such a thing would create vocal outrage. However, I do see some churches that sponsor or partner with food banks, which may be getting semi-trucks of food through the USDA. Well, no, but in America, all churches receive subsidies because they're not taxed. And do you think that the government just decided not to tax churches for reasons of compassion and virtue and theology? No. Somebody else writes, the churches / Christian organizations receiving direct government money. For the most part, those organizations are wearing the skin suits of Christianity, but have abandoned their original mandate to spread the gospel and now instead fill bellies and do not save souls. The corrupting money of the government is on the periphery of Christianity in the US. It's not overt like in Germany and Britain, where the Anglican and Lutheran churches receive direct money from the government. No, the Christian organizations in the US are receiving massive amounts of money for government, particularly for resettlement. Now, the problem for me, you know, I'm no theologian, right? But just in general, the problem with religion at the moment is that women are blocking men from enforcing moral standards. Right, there's an old movie. It's not a very good movie. Susan Sarandon and Kevin Costner, some baseball movie, Wet Sloppy Kisses That Last 3 Days. And in it, you know, the woman says, I mean, she's basically been a bit of a tart when it comes to sleeping with baseball players. And she says, "Hannah, everybody deserves to wear white on their wedding day. Everybody deserves to wear white on their wedding day." So that to me is, you know, boiled down into a foundational nutshell. That is the issue. Is that men want to enforce standards and women want this sort of pathological empathy stuff. In general, tons of exceptions. Right? So men want to enforce standards and women want hugs and forgiveness. And sometimes men are too harsh and they need the hugs and forgiveness stuff. And sometimes the hugs and forgiveness stuff becomes pathological and you need some standards. So men and women have sort of offshored some of this empathy / standards, right? Because the enforcement of standards hurts people. And so if all you're caring about is people being upset, you can't enforce any standards. On the other hand, sometimes standards can be too harsh and punitive and not hear the other person's point of view. And so you need to listen more and maybe have some sympathy, more sympathy, right? So it's a balance, right? But for a variety of reasons, and particularly in the church, men cannot enforce standards. And when men cannot enforce standards, we don't want to play the game. And this is true with dating as a whole. This is sort of a fundamental thing. So when you grew up, as I did, in the glorious anarchy of adult-free, no money, out in the woods, childhood entertainment, then you have to invent all of these rules for your games, and then you have to have a way of punishing people, punishing the boys who don't follow the rules, right? So if you're playing tag, and you tag some kid, and he says, "You didn't touch me," or "You only touched the tip of my shirt, and that doesn't count," like, who wouldn't follow the rules? Okay, you just don't invite him. He's now ostracized, because men don't want to play games where they cannot enforce the rules, i.e. marriage, right? You can't enforce the rules, right? A woman has an absolute right to the man's income. The man has no right to anything the woman may or may not provide in the marriage. Not a single shred, right? So men never want to play in games where you can't enforce the rules. Because then it's not a game, it's just an exploitation. So we would spend a lot of time figuring out what the rules were. And I wrote about this in my novel, Almost, The Battle of the Gardens, a great piece of writing, in my humble opinion, about how the rules are enforced in games without referees. And arguing about rules and rules enforcement is foundational. Because if you can't enforce the rules, there is no game to play. And no game to play is a catastrophe for boys, which is one of the reasons why boys gravitate more towards video games, because in video games, the rules are all enforced, right? I mean, there's sort of punk buster stuff for people who are cheating that way, but in general, the rules are enforced by the computer, by the servers, by the program, the programmers, and so on. So the rules are enforced, and therefore the boys want to play the game, which is why boys move more towards video games and move away from dating. Because in dating, you can't enforce any rules. If the woman has, like, you know, 5 guys on rotation and she kind of ghosts you, and right, then there's no rules, like, even of civilized interaction or behavior or thoughtfulness or anything like that, can't enforce any rules. So men gravitate towards the areas where the rules are enforced, and they avoid the areas where they cannot enforce the rules. Because for men, helplessness is a precursor to death. And this becomes a bit of a surprise to women, and maybe it comes as a surprise to men, but it's really important. So for a man, helplessness is a precursor to death, which is why we avoid situations of helplessness almost literally like the plague. So for a man, you sort of think you're hiking in the middle of nowhere. It's a snowstorm for some reason there, and you're lost. You don't have a map. You don't have a compass. You don't have a phone. So you're going to walk for a long time, and eventually your strength is just going to give out, and then you're just going to curl up, and you're helpless, and then you die. Right? If you're wounded on the battlefield, and they're coming through, and they're killing all the wounded, as was often the case in martial history, you're wounded on the battlefield, you know, like the knights couldn't even get up, right? The armor was so heavy sometimes, so they just come and kill you, right? So you're helpless. So for men, helplessness is what happens before death, right? Like if you have been a really, it's been bad hunting or whatever it is, and you no longer have the energy to hunt, like you're super skinny, you've no longer the energy to hunt, you can't get food, you're helpless, and you're going to die, and your family's going to die, your kids are going to die, right? So helplessness for men, we avoid it like the plague. It's another reason why Twitter is not appealing to me, because I'm helpless as to the maintenance, right? Because the only thing that keeps men from feeling helplessness is physics and honor. Physics is obviously God or nature's rules enforced at an atomic level by the nature of matter and energy. And honor, loyalty, integrity. Integrity is the attempt to turn decision-making into a kind of physics. Like you can listen to my show and you can trust that I'm not going to advocate for communism tomorrow, right? Or, you know, say something crazy like kids should be beaten or whatever it is, right? So there's a kind of integrity to what it is that I do. And that hopefully is not as predictable as physics, because then physics is not creative, right? So then there would be nothing new. But that it all hangs together and fits together and is reasonable, and I'll be if I'm corrected with better information, I'll revise my perspective and so on, right? So you're not helpless in your relationship with me, right? So if I say something wrong and you point out that I've said something wrong and you give me the proof, I'll say, oh, I'm so sorry, I got something wrong, and I will correct it. And so you're not helpless with regards to me. And I don't know if we've usually had the situation in life where we're in a relationship and we try to hold the other person to some reasonable standard of behavior, and there we realize, oh, dang, they're crazy. Yeah, they won't listen. They're just escalating. They're just like beyond all sort of reason or sense or anything like that. Oh, yeah, okay, well, they're crazy. And then you bail, right? Because helplessness is a precursor to death for men. We avoid it like the plague. So if a man or a bunch of men are in a church and some woman does something terrible, right? They're bad with regards to the faith and so on. Then the man will say, yeah, she's out. Yeah, they'll talk to her once or twice, but if she just escalates and won't listen, they'll say, well, she's out. Because men, you can't have any authority and effect with crazy people or people who are narcissistic or selfish or amoral or immoral. And so the men will say, no, she's out. And then the women all get horrified and, oh, give her another chance. She means well, blah, 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 blah. And it's tough, right? I mean, we've all been in these situations in life where, and, you know, it could be male, could be female. We're just talking about women at this point, where the woman is behaving, you know, badly and without recourse to reason or feedback or coaching or whatever it is. And the men are like, she's out, she's gone, she's done, right? This happens in families, right? You've got some crazy aunt who just wants, you know, the MAGA people, I don't know, thrown in prison. And so the men are like, no, she's not coming. Oh, no, but, you know, just don't talk politics. And she means well. She's just, you know, she's lonely and just making up all of this cavalcade of excuses. And then it comes down to the fork in the road. And if the women get their way, then there are no rules that can be enforced and men don't want to play the game. Right? I remember when I was a kid, I mentioned this story before, so I'll keep it brief. When I was a very little kid, I learned how to play chess, and I built my entire strategy. I was playing with my brother, and I built my entire strategy on the king could move two squares, because I thought the king could move two squares. And so I was like so excited to win. I was like 4 or 5 or whatever, right? And I was so excited to win, and I moved my king two squares, and I was told, nope, you can't do that. And we had this old, encyclopedia that I used to read all the time. And it had this old encyclopedia, and we looked up the rules of chess, and I was heartbroken, right? Because I wanted to win. Like, I'm not the least competitive guy on the planet. I wanted to win, and, you know, particularly as a younger sibling, sometimes winning against your older sibling can be quite a sweet, kind of sweet thing. Kind of rare. So I was just like, yep. And so, but if I'd been allowed to make up my own rules, nobody would have played chess with me. Like, the only way I got to keep playing chess was because I was willing to submit to the rules that we got from the dusty old encyclopedia from 1951 or whatever it was. So women can get their way and they can have the rules not be enforced. And then women can have their way, the rules don't get enforced, but then men don't want to play the game, which is why churches have become significantly gynocentric and obviously female oriented, as so has the government, so has education, and so on, right? All right, so let's see here. Cameron says, this was middle school, 13 or 14 years of age, but I think it's closer to the source than 10 years down the road when people realize something's wrong. Later for high school proms, there was more interaction, but only people with dates went anyway. Yeah. For sure. So the churches that are succeeding, I think, are the churches where male authority is balanced with female sentimentality. All right, let's see here. I'll get your comments. Great comments and questions. Thanks, guys. freedomain.com/donate to help out the show, of course. I appreciate that. freedomain.com/donate. All right. I had a date on Friday. She had a lot of that fear of being exploited, for sure. Yeah. It's hijacking of their disgust of weak men. Well, it's funny, of course, because women, you know, claim to be so empathetic, yet the bottom 80% of men don't exist to them, and they have contempt for them. And that's really sad, because, of course, these sort of, quote, weak men are raised without male role models. They're raised without fathers or strong uncles and so on, right? So a weak man is a woman, a weak man. A weak man is a man who's given up on being able to enforce any rules because the sentimentality of women is unrestrained by any reality checks. All right. Are there any bad decisions a man can make that are so easy to make and have such severe consequences as getting pregnant? Yes. Yes. Absolutely. So there are two main bad decisions that a man can make when he's young. Number one is don't talk to women. And number two is don't learn economically valuable skills. So if you don't talk to women and just find out a way to talk to girls and women and find out a way to interact with them in a positive way that they enjoy, then you will not very likely get married. And that's the end of your genes. At least women's mistakes of having kids outside of wedlock, at least the genes probably survive. And the other is to spend your youth having fun, avoiding work, avoiding reality, avoiding feedback, avoiding submitting to the inevitable bad bosses that every new worker has to deal with, because good bosses are much higher in the food chain. Bad bosses are down at the bottom dealing with the noobs. So surrendering yourself to what women want and need, and surrendering to yourself to providing economic value, those are the two massive consequences that are very hard to recover from later in life. You know, so if you turn to, you know, weed, porn, and video games, stay home and don't learn any particularly economically valuable skills, then it's very hard to recover from that. And if you get into your 20s and you don't talk to women, that's a skill, right? Men and women's brains are different and complementary, and you have to figure out how they fit together to produce the spark of glory and greatness that is a male and female brain working together. When male and female brains work together, society leaps forward like unbelievably fast. It is nitro jetpack territory. So you have to figure out where the strengths of women are, where the strengths of you are, figure out how to delegate and work together and have your areas of authority and your areas of surrender, and you're unbeatable if you have that combination. But it takes some figuring out and negotiating, in particular because of the bad propaganda that we're getting. So. I saw a video, a woman rejected telling other women they're too good for men, so make them beg for attention. Yeah, yeah. Now, is that because she wants to block other women from being chosen, or does she believe her own spiel? Is it both? Any way to know? Well, men compete with excellence in general, and women compete with sabotage. I mean, excellence and beauty, but sabotage, right? And there's sabotage elements with men as well. So there's sort of the overlapping circles. But, oh yeah, like he's too, and so women sabotage other women either by appealing to their vanity or setting them up in situations where they can't succeed. So if there's some, you know, Uber Chad who wants to date some average woman, the other women, oh, he's so hot, go for it. You'll regret it forever if you don't, knowing that it's not going to work out, right? All right. Ba-dum-bum, ba-da-bum-bum-bum-bum. But churches don't make money outside of the corrupt megachurch nonsense. I think the nonprofit status is not a bad thing. However, I do see that getting rid of the 501c thing would chase out all of the skin suits and shell churches. Churches don't make money. I'm not sure I follow that. If churches don't make money, then how do they economically survive? Maybe I'm missing something, but I think that churches do make money. Somebody says, I can take the world having unfair rules. My employer is unfair. Okay, find a new job or take help if I'm refused work. Just give me some rules to work with. Being kept in the dark with no idea if I will have work or help and no idea what is wanted from me is maddening. Even the most unfair rules give me a plan on what to do. But if their rules are unfair, they're not rules. All right. You covered that extremely well in your novel, The Present, in the chat between Oliver and his mom. Yeah. Oliver wants to enforce the rules, and his mother wants infinite sympathy for those who suffer. And you can see this, of course, happening. This is what's going on in America at the moment. What is it? The average home price in Washington, D.C. has dropped by $130,000 because there are thousands of homes for sale, right? So what happens, of course, is this is, you can see this divided. And again, it's a little bit more men, a little bit more women on one side or the other. But it is somebody saying, I'm so sad that I lost my job. I was doing great work. I poured my heart and soul into this career. I worked with these amazing people who just wanted the very best for society. And now, you know, cold-hearted Trump is cutting my job, and here's my empty office, and here's my sadness, and so on, right? And again, you could look at the responses. A lot of the women are, I'm so sad for you, that's so bad for you, I'm so sorry for you, that's so sad, it's just terrible, and right, sympathy, sympathy, sympathy. And again, sympathy has evolved for women for very practical reasons. And the men are all like, you know, good, you shouldn't, you should go get a real job and get your hand out of my wallet, right? And Trump is the pendulum of masculinity swinging back into the West. Somebody says, I quit my church because it was too gynocentric, men all standing in the back wearing the babies in those baby harnesses, right? Yeah, so you can know the gynocentricism of an organization is entirely defined by the willingness to inflict discomfort for the sake of rules. If rules that are enforced that make people sad, if they're not enforced because people are sad, you're in a gynocentric organization. James says, ha, ha, churches absolutely make money. They have donation drives, offerings during services and budgets and all that. Source, my father was quite involved in the business of the churches we attended. Yeah. Government employees seem to be unaware they're not actually contributing to the economy. Not contributing to the economy? You know, with some exceptions, they are taking from the economy. Sorry, do I have something? Maybe I'm missing something about what you're saying. But they would be taking from the economy because their work requires other people to change their economic decisions, to spend resources complying, and so on. So again, maybe I'm missing something that you're saying, but it's not like, well, they're not contributing. I mean, they're taking the money and often interfering with the free flow of goods and services in the free market. So somebody says, I was part of an annual business meeting at a church I attended years ago. I found it surprising how much they made and where the money went. I think you have good reason for that. All right. Any other last questions, comments, issues, challenges, problems? Happy to hear from you, my friends. Angelina Belcamino. She's got a very high forehead, and she says, I give good forehead, which is actually kind of funny. She's interesting. So this is a woman who was continually posting about being, you know, I'm 42, I'm child-free, and she'd be drinking in a bar and, you know, partying and all of that. And people are like, why are you alone in a bar at 42 on Thanksgiving? Anyway, so now, and this is post-Trump, right? So post-Trump, she wrote, I'm 42, sober, baby fever, right? So now she's talking about how much she wants a baby at the age of 42. And she considers herself a New York City 9. I don't know. I mean, most women are wearing this skin suit of makeup and filters, so I have no idea how they look. I have no idea how women look anymore. Yeah, so the fact that post-Trump she's now switched to I've quit drinking and I want babies now, the engagement is wild. Of course, she's going to get a lot of engagement from that because all these people, told you, right? And so on. And she's just getting a lot of engagement farming and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I mean, if it's true, and who knows, right? But 42, no boyfriend, not going to happen. Not going to happen. You know, it's funny because for most rules, there are exceptions. And this is how you determine somebody with intel. I mean, there's a couple of ways of determining people with any kind of conceptual intelligence. But one thing, if you say, like this woman who's 42, no partner that I know of, no boyfriend, right? So she's 42, she's single, and she says, I want a baby. If you say, it's not going to happen, right? This is, like, when you say it's not going to happen, you're saying the odds are so tiny as to be virtually non-existent. So it's not going to happen. You know, it's like if somebody says, I want to win $10 million in the lottery, and you say, it's not going to happen. And they say, well, somebody wins the lottery, right? This is a mark of a sort of intelligence, right? So man as a whole, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. And then people say, well, it could happen. So when men say as a whole, it's not going to happen, what we mean is the odds are so tiny, it's the equivalent of not going to happen, right? So is it possible that someone like this Angelina woman, is it possible that she could, at the age of 42, find a guy and have a kid? I suppose it's possible, but given that she's been single for her life and given that she moves in circles where, you know, quality men aren't around, and the higher quality the man, the less he's going to want a 42-year-old ex-drinker with no relationship skills, who doesn't like children, or at least until 5 minutes ago didn't like children. So you can say, but, you know, it could happen. And this is sort of one of the big differences, is a man will say, it's not going to happen. She's not going to have a kid. Now, I mean, I guess she could go and get a sperm donor and so on, but she's not going to have a family, right? She's not going to have a family. So when you say, it's not going to happen, and they say, well, here's a situation under which it could happen, right? She could meet a guy who just loves her to death and wants to marry her within a month. And like, it could happen. It's like, yes, and you could win the lottery. And if you have some, you know, horrible fell disease, you could get some kind of spontaneous remission. Maybe it happens in 1 in 10,000 cases, right? You know, you could blindfold yourself and run across the street and you could be fine. So this is the difference, is that for a lot of the female, a lot of the females are about defying the odds, right? Defying the odds. Now, men do it with martial stuff. Women do it with romance, sex, marriage, and procreation. Defying the odds, right? But in general, men say it's not going to happen, and women get upset. It could happen, right? It could happen. And that it could happen is really toxic. Could happen, right? You know, I don't need to save for my retirement because I'm just going to play the lottery. That's not going to work. It could work. And it's like, yeah, technically it could. All right. A church, by definition, is not a business. Generally, the donations pay for the upkeep of the building, the pastor's salary. At least in the South, they're making 15 to 30K a year. And then the rest is supposed to help the needs of the body first, and then the rest flow out to external charity. I don't understand what you're trying to add to the conversation here. A church, by definition, is not a business. I don't know what that means. I don't mean to sound like dumb. Maybe I'm being dumb. A church, by definition, is not a business. So you're saying it doesn't have to keep accounts, it doesn't have profit and loss, and it can survive continually losing money without subsidies. There's business elements to it. It still has to make a profit. It still has to have an income. It still has to pay people salaries. So a church, by definition, is not a business. I don't understand what that means. Are you saying that it's not a business like a McDonald's is a business? Yeah, okay. I get that. But a church is selling heaven and salvation, and they're charging for spreading the word. And then you say the rest is supposed to help the needs of the body first. The rest flows out to external charity and so on. And it's like, I mean, that's like, you know, reading the business objectives or the social objectives or the political objectives of a government department and saying, well, that's what they say they're doing. But what are they actually doing? As opposed to what is their mission statement? You know, so every now and then when I was younger, you could think of, you know, a first level character. So in Dungeons and Dragons, I don't know what the rules are now, but the way we used to play was if on a 20-sided dice, you rolled a hit. If you roll a 20, that's an automatic hit no matter what. And if you roll a 1, that's an automatic miss no matter what. So a first level fighter could beat a 20th level fighter if for like, you know, 50 rolls in a row, the first level fighter rolls 20 and the 20th level fighter or the 50th level fighter rolls 1. Because that would mean he would just continually chip away at the high-level fighter's hit points, and the high-level fighter would just continually roll a 1 and would miss every time, right? Wouldn't work so well against a magic user, because a magic user would just, there's things that you can't miss on, like magic missile will always hit, or a fireball, you can roll to take half damage, but it would still wipe out. A first level fighter might have 8 hit points, and a fireball is a 6th level spell. It's 66 of damage. And again, I guess the roll, you know, you could survive. So if you happen to roll 66 and you roll 6s, then it wouldn't kill him, but then the second one would, unless you rolled half damage, in which case, so no, the second one would still, you know, 6, 3, 3, so it could survive 2, but not 3. But anyway, magic missiles would take him out pretty quickly. So you could have a battle between a first level fighter and an end level fighter, and if you kept rolling 20s and the other guy kept rolling 1s, you could win. And so men are used to calculating these odds. And if you say to the first level fighter, you can't win against the 50th level fighter, and he says, I could if I roll 50 20s in a row and he rolls 50 ones in a row, I could. Right? But that's like me saying, well, I could emerge from a fight with Conor McGregor where he's dying and I'm uninjured. Well, what's your fighting experience? Well, I did roll some D20s. What's your fight? Well, it's not much, right? You say, well, how could that happen? Well, let's say he has an undiagnosed heart condition. He steps into the ring, and before he hits me, he has a heart attack, and he falls down, and I am uninjured, and he's dying. Could happen. I don't know. He probably has scans all over the place, right? It could happen. But we don't work with could happen, right? Men can't afford with could happen. All right. There are so many women out there who think they will be that rare exception. I may be ignorant if there's more widespread waste and mismanagement than I realized in the churches. Well, if the church is gynocentric, its odds of corruption go up. Because it's all about, quote, sympathy and not about rules, right? No women ever think they're going to have trouble conceiving. They're always shocked it takes more than one go. Yes. Yeah, what is it? Some women say, I spent my entire 20s trying not to get pregnant and my entire 30s trying to get pregnant. All right. Yeah, somebody says, I could take an SAT test to make random guesses and pass with a perfect score, but the sun might have burnt out first. Yes, and if there's an army coming over the hill to raise your village, it is entirely possible, it is within the realm of physical possibilities that all of the invaders could have a heart attack at the same time and die. And you wouldn't need to lift a finger to protect yourself, yet still, it's probably good to train and have a sword. If the church is gynocentric, says someone, it's heretical. Well, I think in general, it just means that rules can't be enforced. Right? I mean, if you've ever played, I don't know, there's a fun game I like called Settlers of Catan. And I was reading this article. This woman was like, she did really well early on in the game and you can sabotage other players. And she did really well early in the game and she's like, and everyone just sabotaged me, and it's like, it's so rude. Like, God, you know, I just want to have fun. And it's like, sorry, man. You know, my wife, when we play Settlers of Catan, if we're playing online, she feels bad. She feels bad putting the knight, which is how you sabotage people. She feels bad putting the knight on even the bots, if the bots aren't doing well. I mean, she's very sympathetic. I love that about her. I really do. Love that about her. She's so incredibly thoughtful. And sympathetic and lovely that way. But you can't run a society that way because then there's no rules, right? Another big mistake men can make, choosing the wrong woman. Yeah, but choosing the wrong woman is related to the two things I talked about before. That's a consequence, right? So I'm talking about the two things that you can really control. So if you know how to talk to women and how to work with women for mutual benefit, and if you study things that give you economic value, then you have a wider swath of women to choose from. Right? You can't have quality without choice. That's why you don't complain about someone's diet in prison because they just eat whatever slop they're given. So a man who chooses the wrong woman is probably a man who's had, well, certainly the less choice a man has, the more likely he is to choose a bad woman, because he's just got to put up with whatever woman will say yes, because he hasn't improved his value to the point where he can choose more, right? I mean, if you only have one job offer and you're starving to death, you have to take that job. Are you picking the wrong job? Well, no, because you got to eat. And if there's only one woman who will date you because you haven't learned how to work with women and talk with women, and you haven't raised your economic value as a man, then can you even really be said to be choosing a woman at all? All right. Let me just check your last questions, comments, issues. All right. Well, I really appreciate you guys' time today. Thank you so much for a wonderful chat. As always, freedomain.com/donate to help out the show. freedomain.com/call. If you'd like a call in, public or private, I'm happy with either. And we've got some great, I got a great call in show coming out soon. A guy introduced me to his inner demon who wanted him dead, and I had a ferocious debate to save his life. It was really, really something. Yes, Steph, agree. Is there an assumption here there are lots of quality women around? Listen, the women that you guys are looking for, if you listen to the show, 1 in 100, 1 in 1,000. So for you, it's all about eliminating and not wasting time. So it's so awesome. I can search up any word on fdrpodcast.com. And I find a show on it. Well, you know, remember, you're donating to me and also for the people who work here. And James has done fantastic work on fdrpodcast.com. You can also get, of course, access to all of the AIs, the call-in AI, the Bitcoin AI, the Peaceful Parenting AI, the General Stephbot AI, in case you have questions that you would like my digital thoughts on. Have yourselves a wonderful day, everyone. Lots of love from up here. Talk to you soon. Bye.